Hello, this is Mary Mortland reading the News Gazette Part 1 for Thursday, October 23, 2025. The headline in the News Gazette, Stifling Their Supply. Book distributors' sudden closure leaves several area libraries scrambling. The impending closure of a major book distributor that has been in business for almost 200 years has left several area libraries in the lurch. When new books come out, patrons are not going to be getting them as quickly as they've gotten them in the past, said John Howard, director of the Mahomet Public Library. I would say my guess right now is the best case we'll be back to somewhat normal by January or February, but in the meantime, there's just going to be delays on bestsellers, and there's going to be delays on non-bestsellers, and we buy a lot of both. Publishers Weekly reported earlier this month that Baker & Taylor plans to end operations by January after an acquisition deal with ReaderLink did not pan out. And American Libraries Magazine reported that the company has had financial difficulties over the past couple years. According to Baker & Taylor's website, the business was founded in 1828 and works with over 5,000 libraries. That includes Mahomet and Tolono, which both used Baker & Taylor as a vendor, and both heard about the closure from sources other than the company itself. Tolono librarian Amy Wildman learned about it when a former employee texted her an article. We didn't hear it from Baker & Taylor, Howard said. We still haven't heard anything from them. I think I heard about it from a staff member who read about it on Facebook. He said that the Mahomet Library previously did over 90% of its purchasing through the company, though it had already begun to establish a relationship with Ingram Content Group, another major book vendor, when the news broke. The transition wasn't easy, however. The library had nearly 900 backordered titles at Baker & Taylor. We had to go back through, determine which of those we still wanted to get, reorder them from another distributor. We needed to make sure that Baker & Taylor didn't end up sending them and make sure that we hadn't purchased them in the meantime. Howard said some of the back orders went back as far as I want to say January 2024, so they had been getting slowly worse over time. He also advised other library directors to inspect their invoices from Baker & Taylor closely, as he's noticed mystery $5 service charges on the library's last few orders with the company. According to Wildman, Baker & Taylor was the Tolono Public Library's main supplier for new releases and editions. I have other sources for kids' books like nonfiction and some picture books, but that doesn't help with the teen and adult books, like the latest James Patterson's that everyone wants to read, she said. Wildman explained that one of the benefits to using a library-specific vendor like Baker & Taylor is that the company would send new books ahead of their release dates. This enabled libraries to label and catalog these titles so that they'd be ready for checkout on the actual release date. Without the advance release agreement, we just have to buy them the same as the public does on release day, which causes a delay in having that processing time, she said. This means that new titles ordered from Amazon could be added to shelves and 3 or 4 days later after the release date, although Wildman added that this is a pretty optimistic estimate. She said there had been signs that something was going on with Baker & Taylor. I would order 60 things a month, like 30 things for kids, 30 things for adults, and I wouldn't get hardly any of those shipments on time, Wildman said, to the point where like 3 months later I was still waiting for something, and I was like, well, people don't even want to read this anymore, and I would cancel the back order. However, Howard estimated it's taken about a month to transfer the Mahomet Library's orders to Ingram, and he expects that most of Baker & Taylor's customers will be switching over to them as well. The struggle we're having now is that Ingram can't keep up, he said, and that's not their fault. The library is still waiting on hundreds of titles at this point, Howard said. Everyone's going to go with Ingram, I think, Wildman said. That's what we're going to do, too, because I haven't heard a better option at this point. In the meantime, while they have this huge increase for customer accounts that they probably weren't counting on 2 weeks ago, we're just getting our staff through stuff through Amazon just so I can get stuff to our patrons who are waiting for the newest releases. She added that media such as audiobooks and DVDs will not be affected, as the library gets these through a different vendor. Electronic materials are also not affected. Every other service should continue as usual, she said. Howard likewise said that the Mahomet Library's digital resources are still available, and patrons could also use this time as an opportunity to find their way back into the stacks and explore older titles. Other area libraries who have been impacted by Baker & Taylor's closure include the Moyer District Library in Gibson City, the Hope Welty Public Library in Cerro Gordo, and the Arcola Public Library, the Rantoul Public Library, and the St. Joseph Township Swearingen Memorial Library. However, not all local libraries are customers of Baker & Taylor. The Champaign Public Library already uses Ingram, said Director Brittany Millington. The Urbana Free Library uses Baker & Taylor, but they have not been our primary provider for some time, said Associate Director Rachel Fuller. The Watseka Public Library has used Ingram as its main supplier for several years and only used Baker & Taylor for audiobooks and Vox books, which are talking books for children, after switching over, said Library Director Darcy Wallace. Don Pippin, director of the Philo Library, said the impact there is also relatively minor. We have three staff members who do purchasing, and only one depended on B&T, he said in an email. I will be helping that staff member switch to another vendor. I had been using Ingram and Penworthy for most of my purchases. I was also aware that Follett, which has been exclusively working with schools, is now working with public libraries. A few libraries made the switch away from Baker & Taylor earlier, such as Allerton Public Library in Monticello, which had previously used the company as its main vendor. We began to see issues earlier this year, not getting books on time, primarily new releases. So we secured another vendor as a backup, Director Sherry Waldrop said in an email. Once the news came out that B&T's buyout fell through, we transitioned, and still are, to this new vendor. Even though we are a small library, it has been a lot of work, primarily because we pre-ordered so many books from B&T. The Catlin Public Library switched to Ingram in the spring, and the Oakwood Public Library made the move in September. Baker & Taylor was the Tuscola Public Library's main vendor until about 3 weeks ago, when Director Devin Black canceled all orders and began sourcing books elsewhere, though he added that the library has definitely been impacted by the company's closure. The Westville Public Library also stopped using the vendor about a month ago amid plans to narrow down the amount of vendors that we use, said Director Nick Sager. Police: suspect fired 5 shots across Green. 18-year-old to be detained until trial. A weekend shooting in the heart of Campus Town involved an Urbana 18-year-old firing 5 shots across Green Street in the first minutes of Saturday morning as students and other bargoers fled, police said. 2 hours later, a house in the same complex where the suspect lives was struck by gunfire, in which investigators believe to have been an attempt at retaliation. DeCoven Stevens will be detained until the resolution of his case after he was charged with attempted first-degree murder, aggravated battery, and unlawful possession of a handgun in relation to the incident. Assistant State's Attorney Andrew Beckett said this was not Stevens' first run-in with firearms, as he had previously been charged as a juvenile with aggravated discharge of a firearm. Stevens had also apparently been shot before, which Beckett said was related to his mother's decision to move them out of Chicago to avoid future negative situations. The bars on Green Street were still open when police responded to reports of a shooting at 12:26 a.m. Saturday, Beckett said, and found people running away. The victim was found in the street with at least 3 gunshot wounds to the shoulder and back. He was treated at the scene before being taken to a hospital for surgery. According to footage from a dash camera in a vehicle and surveillance footage from a nearby business, an individual believed to be Stevens argued briefly with the victim before an unknown woman pulled the victim away. Stevens then allegedly ran up behind the victim with a gun. The victim ran out onto Green Street, and Beckett said Stevens then fired at least 5 times. Police found live 40-caliber casings on the scene and said the window of Royal Barbecue, a restaurant on Green, was shattered by one of the shots. Baguette said police have interviewed the victim, who told them that he was just in the wrong place at the wrong time. However, a house in the same cul-de-sac as the one where Stevens lives was hit by gunfire only hours later. That incident is also still being investigated, but Baguette said preliminary theories connected to the Campus Town shooting. Stevens was seen in surveillance footage from inside Raising Cane's on Green just before the shooting. Employees there were able to identify him because he also works there. Baguette said police executed a search warrant at Stevens' home and recovered two firearms, a pistol and a rifle, one of which had its serial number filed off and the other of which did not have one. Stevens apparently told investigators that neither of them was used in the shooting, which he allegedly admitted to. Baguette said Stevens told police he fired because he thought the victim was going to shoot at him. "I wasn't shooting, trying to kill," he allegedly told them. Champaign County Judge Brett Olmstead ruled that Stevens will be detained until trial. He said that a shooting like this one in such a public space with so many people was a sign that the defendant was a danger to both the victim and the general public. Olmstead referred to the scene not being like a Wild West shootout and said college students who had been out drinking are not alert, making this even more dangerous. Top of the morning, something to get you going today, courtesy of Vice President Jim Rosso. Today, the deadline to buy tickets for annual 40 Under 40 celebration at the iHotel and Illinois Conference Center. The 18th class of Community Difference Makers, backed by Busey Bank, is featured in the current issue of Central Illinois Business Magazine, which will be distributed at the October 30th banquet and available online the same day. To subscribe to CIB, visit our website. This weekend's News Gazette will include our holiday edition of At Home in Central Illinois magazine. Its editor, Carolyn Mail Peterson's favorite issue, at Christmas all the time. For a sneak peek, head to Instagram and Facebook. We'll celebrate all things wrestling at Monday's News Gazette Sports Page radio show at the Esquire Lounge in downtown Champaign. Illini coach Mike Poeta and national champion Lucas Byrd will chop it up on air, and we'll also shine the spotlight on some of the area's top high school programs. Join us in person at 5 p.m. Tune in WDWS 1400 AM, 93.9 FM, or enjoy the podcast at newsgazette.com. Teacher of the Week, Gwinetta Posey, 5th grade, Dr. Howard Elementary, Champaign. Encouraging curiosity. After working as an 8th grade paraprofessional at Champaign's Edison Middle School for 15 years, Gwinetta Posey was introduced to the school district's Grow Your Own Teacher program. The Chicago native graduated from Millikan University in 2009 and has taught at Dr. Howard Elementary School ever since. "I find my work important because I am able to build meaningful relationships that create a safe, supportive, and inclusive classroom community. Also, I've been able to guide students through their challenges, celebrate their growth, and help them become lifelong learners. I became a teacher because I feel every child deserves to have someone who will support their growth, inspire their love of learning, and help prepare them for the next step in their academic learning. My favorite or most unique lesson that I teach is our Civil Rights Wax Museum, where students step into the shoes of historical figures and bring history to life for their peers and families. This lesson encourages students to think critically and make real-world connections. My most fulfilling moments on the job are when the students are eager to plan and present a morning meeting slideshow to the classroom and invite their parents. I keep students engaged by fostering a supportive, positive classroom environment where curiosity is encouraged and every student feels heard. In addition, I'm able to create hands-on activities, encourage discussions, and give them opportunities to take ownership of their learning. Something else I'm passionate about is spending time with my family, friends, and Labrador retrievers, and gardening. My favorite teacher was Mrs. Caldwell at Isaac Newton Elementary School in Chicago. She was my fifth grade teacher and taught me how to multiply and divide. If I weren't a teacher, I would be a plant nursery owner. I enjoy repotting, growing, and watering plants. Pentagon announces next generation of press corps that agreed to new policy. Several conservative news outlets said Wednesday they had agreed to a new press policy rejected by virtually all legacy media organizations and will take their place in the Pentagon to cover Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth and the U.S. military. The new Pentagon press corps will include the Gateway Pundit, the National Pulse, Human Events, podcaster Tim Pool, the Just the News website founded by journalist John Solomon, Frontlines by Turning Point USA, and Lindell TV run by MyPillow CEO Mike Lindell. The Pentagon's announcement came less than a week after dozens of reporters from outlets like the New York Times, the Associated Press, CNN, and the Washington Post turned in their access badges rather than agree to a policy the journals say will restrict them to covering news approved by Hegseth. Hegseth spokesman Sean Parnell announced the next generation of the Pentagon press corps with more than 60 journalists who had agreed to the new policy. He said 26 journalists who had previously been part of the press corps were among the signees. The department wouldn't say who any of them were, but several outlets reposted this message on Twitter saying they had signed on. There isn't even unanimity among organizations that appeal to conservative consumers. Fox News Channel, by far the most popular news source for fans of President Donald Trump, was among the walkouts, as was Newsmax. U.S. strikes eighth alleged drug boat, this time in Pacific. The U.S. military launched its eighth strike against an alleged drug-carrying vessel, killing two people in the waters of the eastern Pacific Ocean, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth said Wednesday, marking an expansion of the Trump administration's campaign against drug trafficking in South America. The attack Tuesday night was departure from seven previous U.S. strikes that had targeted vessels in the Caribbean. Hegseth said on social media that the latest strike killed two people, bringing the death toll to at least 34 from attacks that began last month. The strike represents an expansion of the military's targeting area, as well as a shift to the waters off South America, where much of the cocaine from the world's largest producers is smuggled. Hegseth's posts also drew a direct comparison between the war on terrorism that the U.S. declared after September 11, 2001, attacks and the Trump administration's crackdown. Just as Al-Qaeda waged war on our homeland, these cartels are waging war on our border and our people, Hegseth said, adding there will be no refuge or forgiveness, only justice. Republican President Donald Trump has justified the strikes by asserting that the United States is engaged in an armed conflict with drug cartels and proclaiming the criminal organizations unlawful combatants, relying on the same legal authority used by President George W. Bush's administration for the war on terrorism. Asked about the latest boat attack, Trump insisted that we have legal authority. We're allowed to do that. He said similar strikes could eventually come on land. We will hit them very hard when they come by land, Trump told reporters in the Oval Office. We're totally prepared to do that, and we'll probably go back to Congress and explain exactly what we're doing when we come to the land. Lawmakers from both political parties have expressed concerns about Trump's ordering the military actions without receiving authorization from Congress or providing many details. Appearing alongside Trump, Secretary of State Marco Rubio defended such strikes, saying, "If the people want to stop seeing drug boats blown up, stop sending drugs to the United States." Trump said the strike is ordering are meant to save Americans, and the only way you can't feel bad about it is that you realize that every time you see that happens, you're saving 25,000 lives. In a brief video Hegseth posted Wednesday, a small boat half filled with brown packages is seen moving along the water. Several seconds into the video, the boat explodes and is seen floating motionless in flames. The U.S. military has built up an unusually large force in the Caribbean Sea and the waters off the coast of Venezuela since this summer, raising speculation that Trump could try to topple Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. Maduro faces charges of narco-terrorism in the U.S. In his posts on the strikes, Trump has repeatedly argued that illegal narcotics and the drug fentanyl carried by the vessels have been poisoning Americans. While the bulk of American overdose deaths are from fentanyl, the drug is brought into the country by land from Mexico. Venezuela is a major drug transit zone, but the eastern Pacific Ocean, not the Caribbean, is the primary area for smuggling cocaine. Colombia and Peru, countries with coastlines on the eastern Pacific, are the world's top cocaine producers. Wedged between them is Ecuador, whose world-class ports and myriad maritime shipment containers filled with bananas have become the perfect vehicle for drug traffickers to move their product. Trump levies new sanctions on Russian oil giants in push for peace. President Donald Trump's administration announced new massive sanctions Wednesday against Russia's oil industry that are aimed at moving Russian President Vladimir Putin to the negotiating table and bringing an end to Moscow's brutal war on Ukraine. The sanctions against oil giants Rosneft and Lukoil follow months of calls from Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, as well as bipartisan pressure on Trump to hit Russia with harder sanctions on its oil industry. The economic engine that has allowed Russia to continue to execute the grinding conflict, even as it finds itself largely internationally isolated. Hopefully he'll become reasonable, Trump said of Putin not long after the Treasury Department announced the sanctions against Trump against Russia's two biggest oil companies and their subsidiaries. And hopefully Zelensky will be reasonable too, with, you know, it takes two to tango, as they say. The U.S. administration announced the sanctions as NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte was in Washington for talks with Trump. The military alliance has been coordinating deliveries of weapons to Ukraine, many of them purchased from the United States by Canada and European countries. American chess grandmaster dies, 29. Daniel Noroditsky, a chess grandmaster who started as a child prodigy and quickly became one of the most influential American voices in the sport, died Monday. He was 29. The Charlotte Chess Center in North Carolina, where Noroditsky trained and worked as a coach, announced his death on social media, calling him a talented chess player, educator, and a beloved member of the chess community. Let us remember Daniel for his passion and love for the game of chess and for the joy and inspiration he brought to us all every day, his family said in a statement shared by the center. The cause of death was not immediately known. Noroditsky became a grandmaster, the highest title in chess aside from world chess champion at the age of 18. Years later, the California-born player won the under-12 world championship and spent his teenage years writing chess strategy books as he climbed the world rankings. He was consistently ranked in the top 200 worldwide for traditional chess and also excelled at the fast-paced style called blitz chess, maintaining a top 25 ranking throughout his adult career. Most recently, Noroditsky, known to many as Danya, won the U.S. National Blitz Championship in August. Fellow grandmasters credited Noroditsky with introducing the sport to a wider audience by live streaming many of his matches and sharing live commentary on others. Thousands of people regularly tuned in on YouTube and the interactive streaming platform Twitch to watch Noroditsky play. He loved streaming and he enjoyed trying to be educational. The chess world is very grateful. Hikaru Nakamura, an American Grandmaster, said on a live stream Monday. In a final video posted on his YouTube channel on Friday, titled, You Thought I Was Gone? Naroditsky tells viewers he's back better than ever after taking a creative break from streaming. He talks viewers through his moves as he plays live chess matches on the computer from a cozy home studio. Other elite chess players from around the globe took to social media to express their shock and sadness. Dutch chess grandmaster Benjamin Bach reflected on his lifelong friendship with Naroditsky, who he said he's known since the under-12 world championship that Naroditsky won in 2007. I still can't believe it. I don't want to believe it, Bach said on Twitter. It was always a privilege to play, train, and commentate with Danya, but above all to call him my friend. Naroditsky was the son of Jewish immigrants to the U.S. from Ukraine and Azerbaijan. He was born and raised in San Mateo County, California. He was described by his parents as a very serious kid with an impressive attention span and memory. He went on to study history at Stanford University, earning a bachelor's degree in 2019 after taking a year off to play in chess tournaments. After college, he moved to Charlotte, North Carolina, where he coached the area's top junior chess players. Mayor's campaign fund returns $120,000 from PAC connected to vendors. Mayor Brandon Johnson's campaign last quarter returned $120,000 from two political action committees, both led by developers with active city contracts, the latest instances of his political fund giving back money amid ethical and accounting issues. At the end of August, Johnson's campaign fund gave back $71,000 to Leaders for Tomorrow and $48,500 to ZPACT, according to the latest round of state elections filings that were due last week. That's almost a full refund of what both groups gave, but came after about 10 months after their latest contributions to the mayor's campaign committee were reported, meaning Johnson's campaign had access to that cash for the duration. Since being sworn in for the mayor's office, Johnson's campaign has refunded almost $290,000 in contributions. It has made several amendments to its reports and spent another $120,000 for compliance services. Together, those two pots make up nearly a quarter of his campaign's funds, $1.8 million spending since he was sworn in as mayor in 2023. His political team has previously described the errors as an oversight, while arguing it maintained full compliance with campaign finance law. But whether the Johnson campaign's most recent contribution returns were to comply with city ethics laws is unclear. His political spokesperson, Christian Perry, did not respond to multiple inquiries on the latest refunds this week. Late Cheers star honored where everybody knows his name. George Wendt was a child of Beverly, that tightly knit, leafy neighborhood on Chicago's South Side, where he was celebrated Sunday. He was also a product of Old Town, that equally lovely but more frenetic neighborhood, where he lived for a time and enlivened the stage of the Second City, where he was celebrated Monday. Wendt died May 20th in Los Angeles, where he had lived since 1980 with his wife, Bernadette Burkett, whom he met at the Second City. He was 76 years old. Cardiac arrest was the cause. Newspapers and TV headlines blared the sad news. And so, in from a wicked rain they came. Hundreds packed the pews for an 11 a.m. Sunday Mass at Christ the King Catholic Church, long the Wendt family parish. Many entered to the song Where Everybody Knows Your Name, the theme for Cheers, the popular NBC comedy that ran for 11 seasons, with Wendt appearing in all 275 episodes as the bar denizen Norm Peterson. This has been Mary Mortland reading the News Gazette, Part 1, for Thursday, October 23rd, 2025. Please stay tuned to read Part 2.